This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Spell or High Water by Scott Meyer. Performed by Luke Daniels. The following is intended to be a fun, comedic, sci-fi fantasy audiobook. Any similarity between the events described and how reality actually works is purely coincidental. 1. It was a normal evening at the inn called the Rotted Stump. Outside, the sun was setting and the town was getting quiet. Inside, candles were burning and the patrons were getting loud. Martin materialized across the street. He marveled at how quickly people get used to things. Here he was, a grown man in a shiny silver robe and pointed hat, coalescing out of thin air, brandishing a staff with a bust of a masked Mexican wrestler at its peak. And nobody, not the medieval peasants, nor he himself, found it odd. A passerby said a polite hello as he stepped around Martin. Martin returned the greeting and started across the street. 3 months ago, Martin was a 23-year-old data entry drone in Seattle who poked around in corporate computer systems in his spare time. 2 months ago, through a series of events that barely made sense to him, even though he'd lived through them, he found himself at this very inn in the year 1150, trying to pass himself off as a wizard. About a month ago, with quite a bit of help, he'd passed his training as a wizard. And now Martin was about to meet his very first trainee. It wasn't a huge surprise that the new trainee would turn up here at the Rotted Stump. When fleeing back in time, logic dictated that you use a geological landmark as a landing zone. And if you're going to England, you can't do much better than the Cliffs of Dover. The road nearest to the cliffs led to this town, Ledchurch. And the inn was the first public establishment you found if you followed the road. It was more surprising that Martin had been called to go meet the new arrival. Martin was in his workshop when he got the call from Philip. Word had come that a stranger had arrived claiming to have magical powers. Someone would have to look into it. Philip was much closer, but part of his new job as chairman of the Wizards' Council was to delegate work to others. And in most cases, others meant Martin. Besides, the new wizard was at the exact same inn where Philip had found Martin just 2 months ago. Philip said he liked the symmetry of sending Martin as the welcoming committee. Martin jumped at the chance. Almost since the day he started training, he had looked forward to training someone himself. Martin's training had been a humiliating series of mind games, confusing revelations, and immature practical jokes. He found much of it profoundly unpleasant, and he wanted a trainee of his own. It would be his chance to take all of those miserable experiences and inflict them on someone else, instead of absorbing them himself. Martin paused before he entered the inn. He remembered the night 2 months ago when he'd arrived, hungry and more than a little scared. He had introduced himself to the patrons and proceeded to demonstrate his powers by transforming himself into a laughingstock. Eventually, Philip challenged him to a duel and blasted him into the woods, where he'd hit his head on a tree and passed out. He smiled at the thought of having the upper hand for once as he entered the inn. It was a warm, crowded room with exposed wooden beams. Candles and the sunset filtering through the windows were the only sources of light, which sounded more romantic than it looked. Indeed, not even romance itself would look romantic if it was being seen in the Rotted Stump. Martin scanned the room. It was a busy night. Strong men were drinking strong drinks and using strong language. He was looking for a youngish man, like himself, who seemed out of place, like he did, and was most likely in deep trouble, which he had been. As he peered into the murk, he heard a deep, booming voice shout, "Martin the Magnificent!" Martin tried not to cringe. One of his first acts upon arriving in medieval England was to give himself that nickname. And as with all self-bestowed nicknames, it had been an awful mistake that now haunted him. Pete, the owner of the rotted stump and whose absent right forearm gave the inn its name, got up from a raucous table in the corner and came to meet Martin, smiling broadly.
"Martin, good to see you, lad. Philip couldn't make it?"
Pete asked, patting Martin on the shoulder.
"Yeah, he's busy, so he sent me instead. Is there a problem, Pete?"
"No problem at all,"
Pete replied.
"Just a new wizard in town is all. He showed up dressed in strange clothes. I sent the boy to go fetch Philip right away. I needn't have hurried, though. He seems to be all right. He's already getting on much better than the last wizard that turned up."
Martin scowled.
"I was the last wizard that turned up."
Pete's smile didn't even flicker.
"Aye. He walked up to me and asked if I was in charge. I said I was, and he asks what we have to drink. I point to the beer barrel. He looks at it and says, 'That'll do.' He's been back there drinking and talking ever since."
"Has he offended anyone?" Martin asked.
"No, he fits right in. I think Gert's sweet on him. Come here, I'll introduce you."
As he crossed the room, Martin was able to pick the new wizard out of the group right away. It was his hair that set him apart. It was a fallacy that every man in medieval times had a flowing mane. There were a variety of hairstyles available to the stylish medieval male, but a perfectly trimmed, flat-top buzz cut was not one of them. Martin guessed that the new wizard was in his mid-50s. Beneath his iron-gray, military-grade haircut, he had dark, severe eyebrows and a perfectly trimmed mustache. He was wearing a flimsy white dress shirt and a thin black necktie. Instead of a wizard's robe, he wore a tan trench coat. Martin kicked himself for having not thought of that himself. It seemed as if a dim bar was the new wizard's natural habitat, even if it was a dim bar in the Middle Ages. Pete cleared his throat, and all conversation at the table stopped. The new wizard looked straight at Martin, making eye contact immediately. Gert sat next to the new wizard, towering over him like a slightly feminine oak tree. She had been smiling down at him, but when she looked at Martin, her smile turned effortlessly into a snarl. She liked Martin all right, but she already knew that she liked this new guy more, and she wanted Martin to know it as well. Pete gestured toward the new wizard with his hand and said,
"Martin, I'd like you to meet Roy. Roy, this is Martin."
Roy looked at Martin for a moment, then said,
"Oh yes, the apprentice. Your teacher couldn't make it?"
When Martin arrived in this time, he knew next to nothing. He hadn't known that there were other wizards with the same kinds of powers that he had, that the other wizards were time travelers from the late 20th and early 21st centuries, like he was, or that there was a training and orientation program in place for newly arrived wizards. Not knowing these things, he had made many mistakes. Clearly, the locals had already told this guy, Roy, all about the wizards and the training. They probably had told him about Martin's arrival, and from that, Roy could have figured out that the other wizards were probably time travelers like he was. Philip would have told Martin that there was a lesson in this about listening instead of talking, but Martin wouldn't have listened. Martin smiled at Roy and said,
"Welcome to Lead Church, Roy. You and I should talk."
Roy replied,
"We will, as soon as I finish my beer."
He lifted the earthenware mug to his lips. Judging by how he handled it, the mug was over half full. Martin leaned in slightly.
"It's imperative that we speak. In private."
Roy said,
"I figured he meant in private, or else you'd have just started talking. That's why it has to wait until I'm done with my beer. I doubt that Pete wants me to take his mug. Do you, Pete?
No, Roy. My mug stays in my inn.
See, Martin? So unless you want to put my beer in your hat, we have to stay until I've finished it.
Martin slowly, without breaking eye contact with Roy, removed his silver sequined wizard hat, muttered a few words under his breath, and pulled from the hat a mug identical to the ones Pete used for serving beer. He knew it was identical because he had made Pete's mugs in the same manner and given them to the innkeeper as a gift.
There, Martin said, smiling. This mug is mine, not Pete's, so we can take it wherever we like.
Roy said,
Good. Pete, please fill my young friend's mug with beer. It'll help him kill the time while I finish mine. Martin, you can take a seat, or because that is your mug, you're free to take it and wait outside if you like.
Martin sat at the table in silence, barely touching his warm beer. Roy didn't talk much either. Instead, the patrons of the Rotted Stump seemed eager to tell Roy everything they knew about the wizards who lived in the area, and the events of the previous month, Martin's arrival, the duel in which Martin was defeated by Philip, the mysterious deaths at Rickard's Bend. Martin's mood started to lighten as they described the battle at Camelot and the duel between Martin, Merlin, and Philip. He had to admit, he came off pretty well the way they told it. Going in alone, facing a more powerful adversary to buy his friends time, remaining brave in the face of what looked like certain death. Martin felt rather heroic, until Roy summed up what he had heard.
So Junior bit off more than he could chew, and his trainer had to come bail him out.
There was a tense silence. Martin decided to play it cool. He was the more experienced wizard. He had the upper hand here.
No, Roy, Martin said, shaking his head. There's more to it than that.
Roy snorted.
What did they leave out? Did you cry?
So much for feeling heroic, Martin thought.
Eventually, Roy finished his beer and started to settle up with Pete, who refused to take any payment, calling the drink a welcoming gift. He charged Martin full price for his beer, pointing out that Martin had been in town a while. The two wizards walked out into the chilly night air. Martin had decided not to have a public confrontation with the inexplicably popular newcomer, but now, away from Roy's fan club and with a beer in him, Martin felt freer to talk.
Look, Roy, he said, when I got word you were here, I dropped everything and came out from London to meet you.
Isn't it called Camelot now?
Roy asked.
For the time being. We're going to change that back. Anyway, I came all the way out here.
You teleported here. Don't forget, son, I found the same computer database you did. I know that our world is a simulation, and I know how to use the database to alter that simulation, or else I wouldn't be here in the first place. I know how to teleport. You probably do too, so don't pretend that the distance was some kind of big imposition.
Martin turned on Roy, poking him in the chest with his staff.
Look, Roy, I came here for your benefit. You can get into a ton of trouble around here if you don't let somebody show you the ropes. That's why I'm here, to show you the ropes, to help you stay out of trouble.
Roy brushed Martin's staff away from his chest with exaggerated care.
Okay, okay. Calm down, big guy. Don't get upset. I appreciate you coming to welcome me, but I'm a grown man. I don't need a kid to tell me what's what.
See, that just shows how little you know. There have been guys like us here for over a decade, and others who went further back in time than we did. There's a whole system built on top of that database to do things you haven't even thought of. Things like freezing the aging process. Just because a wizard looks a certain age doesn't mean they are that age. I could be 100 years old for all you know.
Martin stormed off down the street. Roy followed, thinking. Finally, Roy said,
That's a good point, Martin. I hadn't thought about that.
There are a lot of things you haven't thought about, Roy. That's why I'm here.
They walked in silence for a moment. They rounded a corner and were in the town's central square. The lead-covered church that gave the town its name was across the square, but, predictably, it didn't stand out particularly well at night. A few citizens milled about. One or two had torches, but most navigated by starlight. Roy and Martin continued walking across the square. Roy said,
"As you say, you could be older than me."
"Yes, I could."
"But back in the bar."
"In? You should get used to using the time-appropriate words. The rotted stump is an inn."
"Back at the inn? They said you only got here a couple of months ago."
"That's true."
"So you only had your aging stopped then. You're 25 years old, right?"
"23.
"Either way, you're a kid. This has been fun, but is there an adult available to train me?"
Martin stopped walking. Roy stopped after a step and turned around to smirk at him. Martin switched his staff from his right hand to his left, looking thoughtfully at the small plaster bust of Santo, the king of the luchadores, as he did so. He turned his attention back to Roy and calmly said the words,
"Akiri Grandan."
Martin glowed with eerie silver light that seemed to form a grid pattern on his skin. He divided along the grid lines into hundreds of small silver boxes, not dissimilar in shape to tiny coffins. The boxes blew apart, swirling around Roy, who was too stunned to move. The boxes multiplied and reformed into a new form which looked just like Martin, only 3 stories tall and made of glowing silver boxes. As the giant form spun into shape, its empty right hand swept Roy up and lifted him to the giant's eye level. Roy was held around the waist in the immense hand's uncomfortable grip. The other hand held a giant version of Martin's staff. Roy saw that the bust of Santo was also enlarged. Its eyes were glowing with the same sickly light. A voice, clearly Martin's, but louder and deeper, shouted,
"Silence!"
Then Martin's normal, much quieter voice addressed Roy.
"Look, the training isn't just to teach you what you can do. It also gives us a chance to learn what you're likely to do, and if we don't like what we learn, we will make sure that you don't do anything. That's not a threat. We won't hurt you, except in self-defense. We will strip you of your access to the file, that database of yours, and send you back where you came from in such a way that the authorities will be sure to find you. Do you want that, Roy? If so, just say the word. I'm your trainer. I can make that happen any time you like."
Roy squirmed, but the grip of the giant hand didn't loosen. They looked like a toddler playing with a Ken doll, only the doll didn't feel like playing, and the toddler wanted to practice his throw. Martin pushed the head of the giant staff forward until it filled Roy's field of view.
"Do you want to go back, Roy?"
Roy gritted his teeth and said,
"No."
Martin smiled, but didn't move the staff. Not yet. In a much quieter voice, he said,
"Yeah, I bet you don't. Few of us come here because things are going well in our own time. Who's after you back there?"
Roy stared at the giant likeness of Martin's face until it was clear that he wouldn't be put down unless he answered.
"The CIA,"
Roy said. Then, after a breath, he sighed and added,
"And the Department of Defense."
Giant Martin's face cracked a huge smile.
"Wow! I can't wait to hear that story."
Martin pulled his staff away, but kept Roy suspended 25 feet above the ground.
"Here's the deal,"
Martin said, at a volume carefully calculated so that only he and Roy would hear it.
"We wizards have to police ourselves, because there's nobody else who can police us. Part of how we do it is with the training. You can accept me as your trainer, and I'll show you how to fit in here in the past, how to use the powers we've created, and how to make new powers yourself. When I think you're ready, you'll face the trials, and once you pass them, you'll be on your own, free to do whatever you like, within reason. Don't accept the training, and we'll assume you're up to no good, strip you of your powers, and send you back to your time. Perhaps we'll send you to the courtyard in the center of the Pentagon. Not a lot of tourists get to see that, do they? What do you say, Roy? Do you accept the training?
Roy shrugged.
Yeah, kid, I'm sorry. I accept the training.
Martin said,
good,
as he placed Roy back on the ground. As soon as Roy's weight was back on his own feet, Giant Martin silently exploded into thousands of silver boxes that flew outward, spun in space momentarily, then imploded back in on themselves, leaving normal-sized Martin in their place. Roy smoothed out his trench coat and looked around sheepishly.
Jeez, kid, you didn't have to get so sore about it. I was just messing with you.
Well, then you've just received your first lesson. Don't mess with me. Did you learn it, or will you need a review?
No, I got it.
Roy looked at the townsfolk in the square. There weren't many of them, but the few there were had stopped all activity and were watching the two wizards intently.
Did we have to do that in public?
Martin said,
yes. In fact, I put it off until we got here because I knew there'd be people and plenty of room. I wanted witnesses for two reasons. One, it's good to remind the locals what we can do every now and then. Two, it was important that everybody know that I'm more powerful than you.
Important for the training?
Important to me, which as far as you're concerned is the same thing.
Martin reached out a hand to his trainee.
You'll be staying with me during your training. Take my hand. We'll teleport there.
Roy looked at Martin's hand as if he were holding a dead rat.
I'll just put my hand on your shoulder. That should work just as well.
Martin thrust his hand toward Roy.
Come on, don't be a baby. Take my hand.
Roy put his hand on Martin's shoulder and repeated,
I'll put my hand on your shoulder. That should work just as well.
Martin rolled his eyes and said,
I can see this relationship is going to take some effort.
Transporto Magazino! Martin and Roy disappeared. 2. Jimmy walked at a brisk pace. He had a shocking amount of energy for a man in his 60s. That was one of the benefits of spending 30 years riding a bicycle. Another of the benefits was having plenty of time to think. Think and plan. He wasn't riding a bicycle now, and if things went the way he expected, he'd never ride one again. It was just as well, since he'd sold his. The day before, Jimmy had watched Martin lead a low-speed chase to his parents' home, then evade the police by fleeing back in time to medieval England, where he had caused Jimmy no small inconvenience. Once the police and two conspicuously out-of-place federal agents had left, Martin returned, a few hours later from his parents' perspective, several weeks later from their son's, the time traveler. After observing Martin leaving his parents' house by taxi, Jimmy had ridden straight to the homeless shelter he was using as a base of operations. The fluorescent lights flickered, and the TV went wonky as he walked through the shelter's rec room. He had found over the years that as long as he walked through such areas quickly, his disruptive magnetic field would be chalked up to a temporary brownout. He could get away with this for a week or so before someone would notice that the brownouts always happened when he walked by. For nearly 30 years, Jimmy had kept moving, both from room to room and from place to place. Jimmy retired to the private room he had sweet-talked the management into giving him. He went over his notes by flashlight. Batteries and incandescent light bulbs still worked for him. It was only integrated circuits that couldn't tolerate his presence, which included the ballasts in fluorescent lights. He'd had a good night's sleep, then got up bright and early and sold his bicycle to a panhandler for $30. Jimmy took his newfound fortune to the nearest thrift store, where he purchased the nicest suit they had in his size, a white shirt that only had stains on the back, and a tie that didn't have any cartoon characters on it. He also grabbed an ancient Samsonite briefcase. He paid cash. He had to let them keep what little change he was owed because the cash register mysteriously stopped working. He changed into his new outfit in the fitting room and dumped the contents of his backpack into his briefcase. He donated the backpack and his old clothes to the Goodwill, suspecting that they'd more likely burn them than sell them, then set out to face the new day. Jimmy had a plan, and that plan only called for him to look presentable for a few hours. After that, with any luck, he'd be under arrest. Jimmy walked down the pleasant suburban Seattle street. He'd spent so long staking this street out the day before, he knew it as if he'd grown up there. He hadn't, of course. Martin had. Jimmy stopped, checked his notes, made sure he had the right house, then strode up to Walter and Margarita Banks's door. He glanced at the button for the doorbell, then knocked. Three crisp, friendly-sounding knocks. He heard faint sounds coming from inside the well-maintained, split-level ranch house. After a moment, the door opened a crack. A pleasant, dark-haired woman, close to his own age, peered at him through the barely open door. The chain lock was still engaged. Jimmy wasn't surprised. These people had been through a lot the day before and were probably still pretty edgy. The woman said,
"I'm sorry you took so long. I barely heard you knock. We do have a doorbell."
Jimmy smiled.
"I'm sorry, I didn't see it there."
Margarita said,
"That's fine. So, what can I do for you?"
Jimmy's smile faded, the exact amount he had predetermined would convey a sense that he regretted having to bring up the subject he needed to discuss.
"Mrs. Banks, my name is James Sadler, but I'd like it if you call me Jimmy. I know your son Martin. I'd like to ask you a few questions, and I suspect you'd like to ask me a few of your own."
Margarita's smile froze, and all of the light drained from her eyes. She excused herself for a moment. Jimmy smiled kindly and told her he understood. She closed the door and called out for her husband. Jimmy heard bits of the conversation on the other side. He couldn't make out words, but the tone came through loud and clear. Mrs. Banks was upset. Mr. Banks was angry. Mrs. Banks calmed down a bit. Mr. Banks did not. Mrs. Banks tried to soothe Mr. Banks. Mr. Banks responded. Quiet conversation followed. Jimmy took a half step backward to appear less threatening. The doorknob jiggled slightly, and there was a moment of quiet, just long enough for both Jimmy and Mr. Banks to take a deep breath. The chain lock rattled and the door opened wide. Mr. Banks stood, filling the doorframe.
"I'm Walter Banks. What can I do for you, Mr. Sadler, was it?"
Jimmy bowed slightly, just slightly enough that Mr. Banks wouldn't notice that he noticed it.
"Yes, Sadler. James Sadler. Martin calls me Jimmy."
Walter Banks made a sucking noise as he thought. Finally, he said,
"I don't think Martin's ever mentioned you." "No, Mr. Banks, I expect he hasn't. We haven't known each other for long. I'm very impressed with your son. He has a unique combination of intelligence and creativity. You should be proud."
"I am,"
Walter said flatly.
"You still haven't told me what you want, Mr. Sadler."
"Of course. Sorry, I'm a bit nervous,"
Jimmy lied.
"I want two things. I have one question I want to ask you and Mrs. Banks, but before that, I want to answer as many of your questions as I can."
Walter stared at Jimmy for a long time, then asked,
"So, you're involved in Martin's?"
Walter trailed off.
"Difficulties? Yes. At least I was once. I know a great deal about it, and while I won't be able to answer all of your questions directly, I should be able to leave you better informed than you are now."
After another staring match that Jimmy was careful to lose at the exact right moment, Walter invited Jimmy in. An hour later, the Banks's front door opened and Jimmy walked out. Walter and Margarita followed him out the door and saw him off. Walter grasped Jimmy's hand with both of his and shook it vigorously. Margarita gave Jimmy a hug. Jimmy thanked them for their help. And for the sandwich, which he assured them was delicious. Goodbyes were said, and the couple stood for a moment and watched him walk away before finally going back inside.
"Nice people," Jimmy thought. "Martin's lucky to have them."
The conversation had gone well. There was an awkward moment early on when they offered to take his jacket and he refused, but that passed quickly. While he wasn't able to answer the questions they had asked, he had managed to answer the questions they should have asked, and he was gratified that he hadn't had to lie to them.
The easiest way to mislead people is to tell them the truth,
Jimmy thought.
What did Martin do? I can't tell you what he did, but I can tell you that he did not break any laws. What he did was so new, so unprecedented, there just aren't any laws on the books about it. Did he steal something? Or hurt somebody? Heavens, no! Listen, what those men yesterday are after your son for is nothing you'd recognize as a crime. Martin didn't take anything from anybody. He didn't claim to be anything he wasn't. He didn't do harm to any living thing. Except maybe one tree, but it survived.
All technically true. Of course, he had both harmed and taken things from Jimmy, but that wasn't why the feds were after him.
Please understand, Jimmy continued. I wish I could say more, but all I can tell you is that your son discovered something the government didn't know about. He examined it to figure out if it really was what he thought it was, and in the process he came to the attention of the authorities. Now I believe he's just trying to make sure that he doesn't cause himself any lasting legal problems.
That placated Martin's parents. But what really set the hook was when Jimmy made the observation that Martin had always been a little too smart for his own good. They figured he must know their son pretty well if he knew that. After dancing around a few more questions, Jimmy asked them his one question, which they eagerly answered. Then the next 50 minutes were spent eating sandwiches and listening to stories about Martin's childhood. Jimmy reached the end of the street and turned left, taking an extra second to look at the tree that just the day before had been on the receiving end of Martin's car. It looked like it would be fine. Jimmy reached into his pocket and pulled out the piece of paper on which he had written the answer to the one question he'd asked Martin's parents. There was a phone number, and the names Miller and Murphy. When Jimmy asked for the contact information of the agents who had searched the bank's home just the day before, Margarita asked him why he wanted to help her son. He thought,
I didn't say I did.
He told her,
Your son and I had a falling out. It wasn't entirely fair. I just want to make things right between us. I owe Martin that. All true statements, Jimmy thought, and totally misleading. Oh, well, she doesn't need to know that the falling out was over my attempt to kill him.
3. Martin and Roy materialized just outside the door of Martin's warehouse in London/Camelot. There were a few more people milling around, but it was after dark in the 12th century. So a street in a large city like this looked pretty much the same as the street in the medium-sized town they'd just left. Martin said,
So, this is Camelot. Not much to look at in the dark, I know. You'll see a lot more of it in the next few days.
Martin opened the door to his warehouse and motioned for the older man to come inside. They walked into a large open room, about 1/3 of the overall volume of the building. The walls were painted black. The wooden floor was also painted black, except for a blood-red pentagram inside a circle. At the points of the inverted star, there were candles. They lit themselves as Roy entered the room, which startled him. Martin shrugged as he closed the door.
Yeah, they do that whenever someone who isn't me comes in. If it bothers you, I can make them not notice you. It just takes a little programming.
The corners of the room were home to 4 10-foot-tall stone statues of fearsome creatures undreamt of in this time's primitive mythology. Each creature stood atop a pedestal that also bore the creature's names, which were all unfathomable to the ears of the locals. The far end of the chamber was not a wall, but a red velvet curtain. Roy pointed at it and said,
Looks like you stole it from a movie theater.
I did. I worked there when I was in high school. The manager was an awful racist jackass.
Now he's a racist jackass who has to explain to the owner how he let someone steal a huge velvet curtain.
As they walked across the room, Roy asked who or what the monstrous statues were supposed to be. Martin pointed to each, listing their names.
Optimus Prime, Boba Fett, Grimace, and the Stig.
Roy said, "Yeah, I can read. Are those names supposed to mean something to me?" Martin had nearly reached the velvet curtain, but stopped and looked at his trainee, genuinely puzzled.
"None of them ring a bell? Not even Grimace?"
Roy shook his head.
"What year are you from?"
Martin asked.
1973.
"Wow,"
Martin said.
"Seriously?"
"Huh."
Martin took a moment to absorb this, then said,
"Well, none of these guys existed yet in 73, except Grimace, and he probably looked pretty different. Did you ever eat at McDonald's?"
Roy said,
"No."
Martin asked,
"Why not?"
"Because I'm a grown man,"
Roy answered. Martin shrugged and parted the curtain. He gestured toward the gap and said,
"After you."
Roy walked through the curtain into Martin's living quarters, which took up the remaining two-thirds of the building. The walls were bare wood and plaster. The ceiling was a tangle of timber rafters. The floor was raw planks. The space between the walls, the floor, and the ceiling was filled mostly with furniture from IKEA. The layout was what designers in Martin's time called open-plan living. It was one space. The bedroom was distinct from the living area and the dining area, but they were delineated from one another not by walls or partitions, but by where and how the furniture was placed. Now Roy looked confused.
"You live in a barn?"
Martin smiled as he breezed past Roy.
"Pretty much. I mean, the building is in town, so I think of it as a warehouse, but before I bought it, this building's main job was to keep hay dry before it was fed to horses. So, yeah, I guess that pretty much makes it a barn."
Martin walked to his work table and watched Roy explore his living space. The furniture was loosely clustered together in a little over half of the room. The rest of the room was open and empty. Roy walked around the dining room table and chairs, then stopped and asked where the kitchen was.
"Don't have one. We don't really need to cook. Are you hungry?"
Martin asked.
"No, Pete gave me some mutton. He said it was on the house."
Martin remembered that when he'd arrived, the only thing Pete had given him on the house was an assortment of threats and insults. Roy moved on to the color-coordinated couch and easy chairs. They were modern, comfortable, and small enough to be easily maneuvered by one man. He slowly walked toward something he clearly didn't recognize. It was a large, flat slab of black glass and plastic, mounted vertically on a base that sat on top of a wooden cabinet.
"What's that?"
he asked.
"That's my TV,"
Martin said. He picked up a remote control and aimed it at the slab. It played a little jingle and displayed a spinning Samsung logo. Martin turned it off.
"There are no TV channels here, of course, but I use it to watch old movies from time to time."
Roy turned to Martin and in a quiet voice asked,
"What year are you from?"
Martin chuckled.
2012. Have a seat, Roy.
Roy sat heavily in one of the easy chairs. Martin looked at his closed laptop, thinking he'd give Roy a little more time to adjust before hitting him with that. He got up from his desk and sat on the couch opposite Roy.
"So?"
Martin asked.
"What happened?"
"Huh?"
Roy said, snapping out of his daze.
"What brings you to medieval England? And how the heck did you manage to find the file in 1973?
"Nobody else from the 70s is here?"
"No. Until you, the earliest year anyone had come here from was 1984, as far as I know."
Roy puffed up a bit.
"So I found it first."
"Yes," Martin said. "But you got here last, so you can decide for yourself what that's worth."
Roy thought about that, then continued.
"I was an engineer at Lockheed. It's a company that makes airplanes."
Martin said.
"It's called Lockheed Martin in my time. Always kind of got my attention."
"I bet. Anyway, I worked in a division called the Skunk Works."
"Really?"
"Yeah, We mainly did top-secret work for the government.
I know!
High-speed, high-altitude stuff.
I know!
Top-secret projects.
I know!
Look, kid, Roy snapped. Do you want me to tell you the story, or do you already know it?
Martin put his hands up.
Sorry, please. Go on.
Okay. So back in 65, we got ourselves a computer, an IBM 360. We didn't know what the heck we were going to do with it, but everyone figured those things were the future, so they ordered me to learn how to run the thing. I studied and experimented for a while. The company had a few more of them sitting around in other divisions. All of the magnetic tapes for the whole company were stored in one room. One day, I decide to see what other divisions are using the stupid thing for, so I just start loading up all the tapes in there, one by one. One of the tapes has a file on it that appears to be larger than the tape could hold. That got my attention.
Understandably, Martin said. How much could one of those tapes hold?
170 megabytes, Roy answered. What's so funny?
Martin said,
Nothing. Please, go on.
Okay. So I load up the file, and I get a print of the first few thousand characters. It looks like a database.
And eventually you realized what you were looking at.
Yes, Roy said. Proof that the world and everyone and everything in it is just a program controlled by a computer.
And he had a file that could control the computer that controlled the world.
Martin leaned forward and asked,
What did you do next?
I thought about giving myself a bunch of money, but I thought that was probably the fastest way to get caught.
Martin decided to never tell Roy how he had gotten caught. Roy continued,
I decided to use the database to give myself an advantage at work, make my prototype stronger, boost the output of my team's engine designs. I told everyone my secret was advanced computer modeling.
Smart. Did it work?
For a while. There was one project I'd really put my heart into, the A-12. It was a spy plane. It needed to fly very high and very fast. Later, they added a seat and called it the SR-71.
You worked on the Blackbird?
Martin blurted in spite of himself. Roy smiled.
Is that what they call it?
Yeah, eventually, I guess. It went like Mach 3, didn't it?
Officially. It could go a bit faster if it had to.
Martin leaned back heavily into his seat.
Wow! The SR-71! I had a poster of it in my bedroom! I always wondered how they managed to make something like that clear back in the 60s.
It was a long, awkward pause as Martin's smile faded.
And now you know, Roy said. The damn Russians were just so much better with titanium than we were. I thought having good intelligence would prevent wars in the long run, so I found ways to make the plane work. Then I found ways to make it work better. I just got carried away.
And that's how you got caught?
Martin asked. Roy grimaced and said,
I moved to a different project. Then they tried to build more SR-71s. It was top secret, and I wasn't on the team anymore, so I didn't know what was happening. They couldn't get the titanium parts to bond. Eventually, they started asking questions.
And you pictured yourself having a long talk with the CIA, so you decided to get lost.
Bingo. I'd read a book that had just come out, The Best Years to Live in Medieval England, by some guy named Cox. That was a gift. Anyway, I snuck into the chart room and grabbed the coordinates for the Cliffs of Dover, made a side trip to the computer room, entered the coordinates, picked a date, and that's how I got here.
Martin considered this for a moment, then asked,
So, where's your computer?
Roy squinted.
I don't own a computer. I'm just a guy.
What about the computer you used to get here?
Roy kept squinting.
That's Lockheed's computer.
Whatever, Martin said. Where is it?
Where I left it. At the Skunk Works.
Martin had difficulty absorbing what he was hearing.
You didn't bring it with you. Roy! Oh, man. It was a one-way trip for you.
Like I said, kid, I panicked.
Without a computer here, how'd you plan to pass yourself off as a wizard?
I didn't, Roy said, chuckling. I figured I'd use my engineering background to make a living. I walked into that bar, they took one look at me and assumed I was a wizard.
Yeah, Martin agreed. I bet they did.
Martin spent the next hour laying out the situation for Roy in much the same way Philip had done for him. He explained that there were communities of wizards all over Europe in this time, and in various other places at other points in history. He told Roy that all of the wizards were guys like them, who had stumbled across the file in one of its many forms, gotten into trouble using it, and come back in time as a means of hiding. They spent some time puzzling over the fact that while everyone else had found the file on some corporate mainframe, Roy had found it on a magnetic memory tape, but Martin eventually dismissed the topic as just one of the many things about the file and the universe itself that seemed counterintuitive. Martin explained that women who find the file all ended up going to Atlantis, as life everywhere else wasn't particularly hospitable for women with magic powers. Martin was just explaining about chronological pollution and how nothing they did to the past seemed to have any effect on the future when Roy interrupted him by snoring. Martin roused Roy just long enough to get him set up to sleep on the couch. As he tucked a sheet set into the cushions, Roy asked,
"When do I get to meet the guy in charge?"
The guy in charge, Martin thought. There's a thorny issue.
For a moment, Martin considered telling Roy about how the current chairman had only held that position for a short time, and how the chairman before had changed his name from Jimmy to Merlin, and then tried to reshape the entire country according to his whims, which included trying to kill all of the other wizards.
Nah, Martin thought. That's a little too heavy to drop on him on the first night. I'll explain the whole thing later, when we talk about banishment.
Martin answered,
I don't know when you'll meet the chairman. It'll happen at some point, but it's hard to say when. He's a busy guy.
4. Some would think that Philip enjoyed being the chairman of the wizards, in spite of the busy schedule that came with the job. Philip would tell you that he enjoyed being chairman because of the busy schedule. Many people found this hard to understand, but those people hadn't actually seen the schedule. Philip rolled out of bed at his official residence, the same hut he'd lived in for the last 10 years. He stretched his back and regretted for the 1,000th time that he hadn't gained the ability to freeze the aging process until he was in his 40s, and predictably thick around the middle. He pulled some breakfast out of his hat and ate it in a bleary haze. When breakfast was done and he was mostly awake, Philip grabbed his wizard staff, put on his pointy hat and light blue robe, and commuted to work. Some days he'd make a show of flying to his shop in public, but today he simply teleported there. He had a full agenda and he wanted to get to it. He appeared in front of his building, entered right away, and walked through the storefront that was just there for show. He went straight through the séance room with its fake crystal ball. He climbed the staircase at the back of the building and reached his goal, the second story, which was decorated with the finest furnishings and entertainment devices that 1984 had to offer. He pushed a button on the massive Sony stereo, and the room quietly filled with the resonant sounds of the Alan Parsons Project. He walked to the chrome and white plastic bar and looked at his official schedule. Item 1. Get up. Done. Item 2. Eat breakfast. Done. Item 3. Think up some busy work and delegate it to a wizard who'll make a lot of noise about it. Philip thought for a moment about the busy work and about whom to make busy with it. His eyes drifted around the room, past his Commodore 64 computer, past the mint-condition Pontiac Fiero he kept inside as if it were a work of art. His gaze lingered on his original stand-up arcade Gorf cabinet. He remembered how he had carefully dismantled it and transported it back in time one piece at a time. He saw the scratches around the cabinet's coin box and remembered seeing Magnus, the younger of the two wizards who resided in Norway, trying to pry it open. That answered the question of who, but he still needed to think of a what. After a few moments, he called Magnus on what the wizards euphemistically called the hand phone. He raised his right hand in front of his face, as if imitating a Shakespearean actor reciting the Alas, Poor Yorick speech. Philip said,
Communiqui cun Magnus tu.
Almost instantly, Philip's raised hand was filled with Magnus's placeholder icon, a flickering, semi-transparent image of the devil sticking out his tongue. The demon's left hand held the neck of a white, V-shaped guitar. The other hand was making a devil horns gesture.
It's redundant for the devil to make devil horns, Philip thought. He could just point at his horns and send the same message.
Finally, the image of the devil was replaced with a bleary-eyed Magnus. Clearly, Philip had woken him. The image of Magnus's head said,
Hey, Philip.
Good morning, Magnus. How's Magnus?
Philip replied. Magnus's best friend was also a wizard who lived in Norway, who was also named Magnus.
He's Magnus, Magnus answered. You know what I mean?
I think I do.
What's up?
Philip said,
Official business, I'm afraid. As you know, I am now the chairman of the wizards.
Well, yeah, I voted for you. It was only 2 months ago.
Philip smiled.
Right. Well, I've decided that we need to take a census.
A census?
Magnus said, clearly thinking he'd misunderstood.
Yes. We need to count and list every wizard in Europe,
Philip explained patiently. Magnus squinted and said,
But Phil, you know every wizard in Europe.
Well, that's the thing, Philip said. I think I do. We both think we do, but we can't be sure. For all we know, David out in Russia might know another wizard who we never mentioned because he assumed we already knew about him.
Magnus kept on squinting.
I guess that's true. Why are you calling me?
Here we go, Philip thought. Magnus, I'd like for you to make a list of all the wizards in Europe that you know of.
Magnus nodded and said,
Okay, I can do that.
Good,
Philip said.
Then I want you to call every wizard on that list and ask them to make the same list.
Magnus's eyes widened.
You want me to call everyone?
Yeah,
Philip said brightly.
It's not like I'm asking you to go see them in person.
Yeah, I suppose not,
Magnus agreed, grudgingly.
Unless someone comes up with a wizard you've never heard of, then I want you to go track them down and get their information.
What kind of information?
You know, who they are, where they're from, where they found the file, the basics.
How soon do you need this, Philip?
Oh, there's no particular rush. A couple of days, I guess.
Magnus sucked his teeth, then said,
That's fine if there are no new wizards. If I do have to hunt someone down, I'll need more time. Can I have a week?
Philip looked disappointed, but said,
Of course, Magnus. If that's how long it takes.
They said their goodbyes, and Philip turned his attention back to the list. Item 3. Think up some busy work and delegate it to a wizard who'll make a lot of noise about it. Done for the week. On to item 4. Item 4. Do whatever you like for the rest of the day. Philip played some Gorf, then settled into his most comfortable chair to read his dog-eared copy of Catch-22. He had been reading for about an hour when he heard the noise. It wasn't an inherently alarming noise. It sounded like someone at the foot of his staircase had rung a crystal bell. The sound shook Philip down to his bones, since he didn't own a crystal bell. And due to his magical security measures, it shouldn't have been possible for anyone to be at the foot of his stairs. Philip put down his book, grabbed his staff, and carefully crept to the head of the staircase. Carefully, he peered down into the distance below, and was thoroughly confused by what he saw there. 5. Martin didn't know what his next move would be, but he knew he'd have to make it in the next 5 seconds. He was flying as fast as he dared, at an altitude of 7 feet above the forest floor, high enough to not get caught in the undergrowth, but low enough to avoid getting hung up in the canopy. He held his staff in front of him, tilted so as to be parallel to his body. The last thing he needed was his staff slamming into a tree trunk, sending him falling in a heap to the ground. He couldn't slow down because one of his pursuers was flying right behind him. Martin was sure he was losing ground, since he had to find his way through the trees, while all his attacker had to do was follow him and fly through the Martin-shaped hole. Martin would have just flown straight up, punching through the canopy and emerging into the clear blue sky above, except that he knew there was a second pursuer lurking up there, waiting for Martin to emerge into the open, presenting a clear target. Martin glanced upward and saw a black shape moving fast above the treetops. He lowered his gaze just in time to see and almost dodge a dead limb hanging limply from the live branches that supported its weight. He tried to swoop under it, but wasn't quite fast enough. It grazed painfully across his back, then fell to the forest floor. In an act of hopefulness, Martin glanced behind him and cursed when he saw the purple blur that was gaining on him zip right over the top of the fallen branch without having to alter course or even decelerate. He knew from memory that a river cut through the woods, and that he'd be reaching it soon. He would lose his cover and be a sitting duck for the bogey above the trees. If, on the other hand, he slowed enough to turn away from the river, the purple blur behind him would overtake him and knock him out of the air. To make matters worse, there was a third attacker out there somewhere who had been delayed at the start of the chase, but would certainly be back into the fray by now. Martin only had himself to blame. He had gotten so caught up in the excitement of having a trainee that he'd forgotten that there were people who would attack him on sight. The day had started on such a positive note. Martin awoke to find that Roy was already up. Martin produced breakfast for them, and while Roy was amusingly disturbed to eat food that had been pulled out of a wizard's hat, he was clearly equally disturbed that the breakfast consisted of a McDonald's bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit and a solid slab of hash browns. Once breakfast was done, Martin set about getting Roy up to speed. Martin showed Roy his top-of-the-line 2012 laptop, which, since Roy was from 1973, was as astonishing to him as any magic trick Martin had done. Martin explained that until recently, the wizards from farther in the future had tried to keep later technology from the earlier wizards in the interest of not messing up the timeline more than they had to, but that recent events had shown that this put earlier wizards at an unfair disadvantage, and that the timeline didn't seem to care what they did. Roy asked Martin to explain that last part, and Martin explained that most wizards went back to their original time on a regular basis, and that nobody had found a single change, no matter what the wizards did in the past. He briefly explained the two predominant theories, that they existed in a separate timeline created by whatever program used the file, or that at some point in the future, something would happen to clean up the mess they were currently making. Martin trailed off when it became clear that Roy had lost interest in the philosophical discussion and just wanted to play with Martin's computer.
Maybe we'll get along after all, Martin thought.
Once Roy was done boggling over Martin's laptop, Martin explained about the Shell program, the interface that Philip and the former chairman Jimmy had developed to make it easy to utilize the file that brought them all here. He explained to Roy the powers that the Shell could bestow upon anyone who knew that it existed and took the time to learn how to use it. He told Roy that he need not age. He'd never be too cold or too hot again. He could speak any language fluently. Most important, he explained that while he still needed food, water, and air, he was impervious to physical damage. If Roy wore a robe and hat that met certain measurements exactly, the Shell would recognize him as a wizard, and he'd have the powers of flight, teleportation, and the ability to create food, money, and almost anything else out of thin air. Martin also promised Roy that when his training was complete and he'd passed his trials, that Martin would set him up with a laptop so that he could go back to his own time at will if he wanted.
That's if you accept the training. If you choose not to, I'll just assume you're up to no good and send you back home so the CIA can pick you up. So, Roy, do you accept the training?
With a sales pitch like that, Roy didn't have to think.